Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
All right. Welcome to another installment of It's My House. And we took about 3 days off last week because we're doing some offline event planning for our series of It's My House live events. So let's see. Now, we're trying to get back into the studio here. Things are kind of moving slow on the podcast. But anyway, today's podcast is titled Facing Your Giants. And we have a motivational piece on that today. So let's get back to our regular startup with we've done Claude Anderson. Let's move some mountains.
To me.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Speaking of the quality and power of love, on this new day, fresh and clean and unused, moldable to your touch, reminds me strongly of an old fable. The sun and the wind agreed to hold a contest to determine which was stronger. One day when the wind was roaring and bragging about his strength, the sun challenged him in the fable. The sun said, "I see a way to decide our dispute. The one who can make that traveler take off his heavy cloak shall be the stronger." The wind agreed and said he'd try first. And the wind whirled and swirled about the traveler, almost whipping the coat to rags. But the harder the wind blew, the colder grew the atmosphere. The traveler wrapped his coat about him tighter than ever before. Finally, the wind gave up, admitted his failure, declared also the sun would fail. But the sun just smiled and let his rays fall gently on the traveler down below. Soon the traveler grew so warm, he had to remove his coat to keep cool. Now love is like the sun. Its very existence and expression creates warmth. It doesn't have to whip at a man and roar and rant to be effective. The simple awareness of love is effective. Did you ever watch clouds disperse on a dark day when the sun suddenly began to shine through? the clouds seemed to completely dissolve, melt away. You yourself have that same power within you to dispel all your troubles today, all your perplexities, all your distresses. Stop talking, stop thinking about your problems all the time. Such action aggravates your troubles. Brighten your mind with the conscious happiness of love. Take the advice of a wise philosopher. Do something for somebody else quickly when you're depressed. Do something for somebody else quickly when you're depressed. Such an action will brighten and change your entire outlook in a flash. One of the most interesting facets of love is the simple fact that only in the welfare of our fellow man can we attend properly to our own welfare. When we work for our neighbor, in reality, we are working for ourselves, and we are working with God, who needs us to carry out his will and to help him help others. When God's will has been fully carried out, we've reached the pinnacle of success, peace, even world peace. I'm often amazed at the complexities we humans assume must provide the victories we strive so hard, so clumsily to win. Somehow it seems only the poets have grasped the happy simplicity of real life satisfaction. The quality love, for example, is in its essence supremely simple. But poets, rather than the so-called great thinkers, are the ones who fully grasp the significance and the meaning of love. Consider the simplicity of these soaring lines. When your heart is in despair, add more love unto your prayer. Love will meet the need. When you find a rugged way, when you have a long, hard day, when for help you pray and pray, love will meet the need. When your heart is feeling fear, love will meet the need. Love will help in all you do. Love will help you to be true. Love will meet the need. God as love will banish hate, if on him you only wait. Love will meet the need. All your needs will be supplied, if on love you have relied. Not a thing will be denied. Love will meet the need. Or listen to these singing words, one of the most beautiful prayers that I know. Teach me to love. There was a time when in my daily prayer, I asked for the things I deemed most fair and necessary to my life's success. Riches, of course, and ease and happiness. A host of friends, a home without alloy, a primrose path of luxury and joy, social distinction and enough of fame to leave behind a well-remembered name. Ambition ruled my life. I longed to do great things that all my little world might view and whisper, wonderful. Ah, patient God, how blind we are until thy shepherd's rod of tendering chastening gently leads us on to better things. Today, I have but one petition, Lord. Teach me to love. Indeed, it is my greatest, my only need. Teach me to love, not those who first love me, but all the world, with that rare purity, a broad, outreaching thought, which bears no trace of earthly taint, but holds in its embrace humanity, and only seems to see the good in all reflected, Lord, from thee. And teach me, Father, how to love most, those who most stand in need of love, that host of people who are sick and poor and bad, whose tired faces show their lives are sad, who toil along the road with footsteps slow, and hearts more heavy than the world can know. People, when others pass discreetly by, they fail to hear the pleading of their cry, for help amid the tumult of the crowd, whose very anguish makes them cold and proud, resentful, stubborn, bitter in their grief. I want to bring them comfort and relief, to put my hand in theirs, and at their side walk softly on, a faithful, fearless guide. Help me to feel these sad ones doubly dear, because they need so much. Help me to seek and find that which they thought was lost, to speak such words of cheer that, as we pass along, the wilderness shall blossom into song. Ah, love divine, how empty was that prayer of other days, that which once was so fair, those flimsy baubles that the world calls joys, are nothing to me now but broken toys, outlived, outgrown. I thank thee that I know those much-desired dreams of long ago, like butterflies, have had their summer's day, of brief enchantment have gone. I pray for better things. Thou knowest God above, my one desire now, teach me to love. What could be simpler than the thoughts in these lines? A child can understand them. Yet so many of us neglect or somehow are unable to make use of their protection against happiness, unhappiness, sorrow, suffering, fear, envy, worry. We permit ourselves to be tangled in imagined complexities and thus lose sight of love's utter simplicity. Every human being needs and ardently wishes to love and to be loved. But say the many who get lost on the way, the people I know don't seem to want or need my love or appreciation or understanding. Some of them almost make a point of telling me they don't even want my friendship. Don't you believe it? Do the flowers need sunshine and rain? Of course. The people around you want and need your goodwill and affection just as much as the flowers need sunshine and rain. Maybe they've been fooling you. They may even have fooled themselves into the belief they can get along without your love or anybody else's love. Fear, a sense of insecurity, or lack of understanding can often make human beings act and on the surface even feel exactly opposite to their basic desires. But every person in the world wants love, whether consciously or unconsciously. Your own heart, with understanding and love, can cut through the negative, untruthful, and unconscious outer layer of somebody else's fear and timidity and misunderstanding. Reach in, meet a fellow human being's deep, true wish for love and need and understanding and thirst for appreciation. We all want appreciation so very much. If you try sincerely to fill this need for love and understanding and appreciation, others will be forced out of their shells, no matter how thick or hard, into the warmth of human love. The underlying unity and harmony of life demands that we extend to others all the goodwill and kindness and generosity and love we hope to receive from them. To have a friendly attitude toward others is indispensable to our own successful living. Emerson's well-known phrase, "The only way to have a friend is to be one," was much more than virtuous sentiment. Love felt sincerely in your heart for all mankind will keep you stable and calm, serene, poised, in whatever circumstances you may find yourself. Love can heal your discord of mind, your body, or the day-to-day affairs of the world you live in. Envelop yourself in it. Immerse yourself so fully and so deeply that love radiates to all about you and reflects back to yourself. Remember these words. You cannot be critical and radiate love. You cannot be selfish and radiate love. You cannot be angry and radiate love. Try another experiment. Consider for a moment some individual from whom you feel no sentiment of love or affection. Then try to think how you would react if you should learn this person felt only love for you. The result of this little exercise alone may surprise you. Through the love you express, you can accomplish anything you desire, eliminate anything or any condition that might otherwise work against you. So, in one way or another, to define love is an admonition. Be the friend you want. Be courteous, be gentle, be kind. Above all, be understanding of yourself, of your own shortcomings, as well as those of others. If a friend understands you, it's obvious this understanding brings out the best within you. Remember, this works both ways. If you understand a friend, you bring out the best within his makeup. You may even help the friend find within himself forces and powers and love of which he's unaware. There's a poem called Friendship, written by Francis J. Gable, that always comes to my mind when I think about human beings trying to make friends. Says Gable, "I want the man I meet each day, wherever I may be, to know that joy and happiness just radiate from me. I want to put so much into the hand clasp I extend that every man I meet will say, I know he'll be a friend. I want to greet my fellow man with such a hearty smile that will banish all their care and make life seem worthwhile. I want to understand their need and such assistance lend that every man I know will feel, I'm glad he's my friend. I ask not honor nor reward for anything I do. I just would open wide my heart and let the love shine through. Though I but meet a brother once, one touch, one smile I'd send, and cause that man to sing for aye, I'm glad he's my friend." And so, friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Easton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
So, Coach, how strong is Westview this year?
A lot stronger than we are.
You already written Friday night down as a loss, Brock?
Well, not if I know we could beat them.
Come here, Brock. You too, Jeremy.
What, am I in trouble now?
Not yet. I want to see you do the death crawl again, except I want to see your absolute best.
What, you want me to go to the 30?
I think you can go to the 50.
The 50? I can go to the 50 if nobody's on my back.
I think you can do it with Jeremy on your back. But even if you can, I want you to promise me you're going to do your best.
All right.
Your best.
Okay.
You going to give me your best?
I'm going to give you my best.
All right, one more thing. I want you to do it blindfolded.
Why?
Because I want you giving up at a certain point when you can go further. Get down. Jeremy, get on his back. Now get a good tight hold, Jeremy. All right. Let's go, Brock. Keep your knees off the ground. Just your hands and feet. There you go. A little bit left. A little bit left.
I bet he does.
There you go. Jeremy, good effort. That way, Brock. You keep coming. There you go. It's a good start. A little bit left. A little bit left. There you go, Brock. Good strength. That's it, Brock. That's it.
Am I at the 20 yet?
Forget the 20. You give me your best. You keep going. That's it. No, don't stop, Brock. You got more in you than that.
I ain't done. Just rest in a second.
You gotta keep moving. Let's keep moving. Let's go. Don't quit till you got nothing left. There you go. Keep moving. Keep moving. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Your very best. Your very best. Your very best. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. Don't quit on me. Keep going. Keep driving it. Keep your knees off the ground. That's it. Your very best. Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Don't quit till you got nothing left. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. I want everything you got. Come on. Keep going.
It hurts.
Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go.
He's heavy.
I know he's heavy.
I'm out of strength.
Then you negotiate with your body to find more strength, but don't you give up on me, Brock. You keep going, you hear me? You keep going. You're doing good. You keep going. Do not quit on me. You keep going.
It hurts.
I know it hurts. You keep going. You keep going. It's all hard from here. 30 more steps. You keep going, Brock. Come on. Keep going.
It hurts.
And let it burn!
Ours are burning!
It's all ours! You keep going, Brock! Come on! Come on! Keep going! You promised me your best! Your best! Don't stop! Keep going!
Too hard!
It's not too hard! You keep going! Come on, Brock! Give me more! Give me more! Keep going! 20 more steps! 20 more! Keep going, Brock! Give me your best! Don't quit! No! Keep going! Keep going! Keep going! Don't quit! Don't quit! Don't quit! Brock Kelly, you don't quit! Keep going! Keep going! Go, Brock Kelly! You don't quit on me! No! You keep going! You keep going! Go, Brock! 10 more steps! 10 more! 10 more! 10 more! Keep going! Don't quit! Give me your heart! You can! You can! 5 more! 5 more! Come on, Brock! Come on! Don't quit! Don't quit! Come on, Brock! 2 more! 1 more!
It's got to be 50. It's got to be 50. I don't have any more.
Look up, Brock. You're in the end zone. Brock, you are the most influential player on this team. If you walk around defeated, so will they. Don't tell me you can't give me more than what I've been seeing. You just carried a 140-pound man across this whole field on your arms. Brock, I need you. God's gifted you with the ability of leadership. Don't waste it.
Coach?
Can I count on you?
Yes.
Coach?
What is it, Jeremy?
I weigh 160.
So I wanted to tell a story that that really obsessed me when I was writing my new book. And it's a story of something that happened 3,000 years ago when the kingdom of Israel was in its infancy. And it takes place in an area called the Shephelah in what is now Israel. And the reason the story obsessed me is that I thought I understood it, and then I went back over it and I realized that I didn't understand it at all. Ancient Palestine had along its eastern border, there's a mountain range, still same is true of Israel today. And in the mountain range are all of the ancient cities of that region. So Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron. And then there's a coastal plain right along the Mediterranean where Tel Aviv is now. And connecting the mountain range with the coastal plain is an area called the Shephelah, which is a series of valleys and ridges that run east to west. And you can follow the Shephelah, go through the Shephelah to get from the coastal plain to the mountains. And the Shephelah, if you've been to Israel, you'll know it's just about the most beautiful part of Israel. It's gorgeous with forests of oak and wheat fields and vineyards. But more importantly, though, in the history of that region, it's had a real strategic function. And that is, it is the means by which hostile armies on the coastal plain find their way, get up into the mountains and threaten those living in the mountains. And 3,000 years ago, that's exactly what happens. The Philistines, who are the biggest of enemies of the kingdom of Israel, are living in the coastal plain. They're originally from Crete. They're a seafaring people. And they may start to make their way through one of the valleys of the Shephelah up into the mountains, because what they want to do is occupy the highland area right by Bethlehem and split the kingdom of Israel in two. And the kingdom of Israel, which is headed by King Saul, obviously catches wind of this, and Saul brings his army down from the mountains, and he confronts the Philistines in the Valley of Elah, one of the most beautiful of the valleys of the Shephelah. And the Israelites dig in along the northern ridge, and the Philistines dig in along the southern ridge, and the two armies just sit there for weeks and stare at each other because they're deadlocked. Neither can attack the other, because to attack the other side, you've got to come down the mountain into the valley and then up the other side, and you're completely exposed. So finally, to break the deadlock, the Philistines send their mightiest warrior down into the valley floor, and he calls out and he says to the Israelites, send your mightiest warrior down and we'll have this out, just the two of us. This was a tradition in ancient warfare called single combat. It was a way of settling disputes without incurring the bloodshed of a major battle. And the Philistine who sent down their mighty warrior is a giant. He's 6'9". He's outfitted head to toe in this glittering bronze armor. And he's got a sword, and he's got a javelin, he's got a spear. He is absolutely terrifying. And he's so terrifying that none of the Israelite soldiers want to fight him. It's a death wish, right? There's no way they think they can take him. And finally, the only person who will come forward is this young shepherd boy. And he goes up to Saul, and he says, I'll fight him. And Saul says, you can't fight him. That's ridiculous. You're this kid. This is this mighty warrior. But the shepherd is adamant. He says, no, you don't understand. I have been defending my flock against lions and wolves for years. I think I can do it. And Saul has no choice. No one else has come forward. So he says, all right. And then he turns to the kid. And he says, but you've got to wear this armor. You can't go as you are. So he tries to give the shepherd his armor, and the shepherd says, no. He says, I can't wear this stuff. The biblical verse is, I cannot wear this, for I have not proved it. Meaning, I've never worn armor before. You've got to be crazy. So he reaches down instead on the ground and picks up 5 stones and puts them in his shepherd's bag and starts to walk down the mountainside to meet the giant. And the giant sees this figure approaching and calls out, come to me so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, right? He issues this kind of taunt towards this person coming to fight him. And the shepherd draws closer and closer, and the giant sees that he's carrying a staff. That's all he's carrying, right? Instead of a weapon, just this shepherd's staff. And he says, he's insulted. Am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks, right? And the shepherd boy takes one of his stones out of his pocket, puts it in his sling, and whirls it around and lets it fly, and it hits the giant right between the eyes, like right here in his most vulnerable spot, and he falls down either dead or unconscious, and the shepherd boy runs up and takes his sword and cuts off his head, and the Philistines see this and they turn and they just run. And of course the name of the giant is Goliath, and the name of the shepherd boy is David. And the reason that story has obsessed me over the course of writing my book is that everything I thought I knew about that story turned out to be wrong. Right? So David in that story is supposed to be the underdog, right? In fact, that term, David and Goliath, has entered our language as a metaphor for improbable victories by some weak party over someone far stronger. Now, why do we call David an underdog? Well, we call him an underdog because he's a kid, little kid, and Goliath is this big, strong giant. We also call him an underdog because Goliath is an experienced warrior, and David is just a shepherd, right? But most importantly, we call him an underdog because all he has is that Goliath is outfitted with all of this modern weaponry, right? This glittering coat of armor and a sword and a javelin and a spear, and all David has is this sling. Well, let's start there with the phrase, all David has is this sling, because that's the first mistake that we make. In ancient warfare, there are 3 kinds of warriors. There's cavalry, men on horseback and with chariots. There is heavy infantry, which are foot soldiers, armed foot soldiers with swords and shields and some kind of armor. And there's artillery. And artillery are archers, but more importantly, slingers. And a slinger is someone who has a leather pouch with 2 long cords attached to it. And they put a projectile, either a rock or a lead ball, inside the pouch. And they whirl it around like this. And they let one of the cords go. And the effect is to send the projectile forward towards its target. Right? That's what David has. And it's important to understand that that sling is not a slingshot. It's not this, right? It's not a child's toy. It's, in fact, an incredibly devastating weapon. When David rolls it around like this, he's turning the sling around probably at 6 or 7 revolutions per second. And that means that when the rock is released, it's going forward really fast, probably 35 meters per second. That's substantially faster than baseball thrown by even the finest of baseball pitchers. More than that, the stones in the Valley of Elah were not normal rocks. They were barium sulfate, which are rocks twice the density of normal stones. If you do the calculations on the ballistic, on the stopping power of the rock fired from David's sling, it's roughly equal to the stopping power of a 45 millimeter handgun. Right? This is an incredibly devastating weapon. Accuracy, we know from historical records that slingers had, experienced slingers could hit and maim or serious or even kill a target at distances of up to 200 yards. From medieval tapestries, we know that slingers were capable of hitting birds in flight. They're incredibly accurate, right? When David lines up, and he's not 200 yards away from Goliath, he's quite close to Goliath. When he lines up and fires that thing at Goliath, he has every intention and every expectation of being able to hit Goliath at his most vulnerable spot between his eyes. If you go back over the history of ancient warfare, you will find time and time again that slingers were the decisive factor against infantry in one kind of battle, against heavy infantry in one kind of battle or another. So what's Goliath? He's heavy infantry. And his expectation when he challenges the Israelites to a duel is that he's going to be fighting another heavy infantryman. Right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the key phrase is come to me. Come up to me because we're going to fight hand to hand like this. Saul has the same expectation. David says, I want to fight Goliath, and Saul tries to give him his armor because Saul is thinking, oh, when you say fight Goliath, you mean fight him in hand-to-hand combat, infantry on infantry. But David has absolutely no expectation. No, he's not going to fight him that way. Why would he? He's a shepherd. He's spent his entire career using a sling to defend his flock against lions and wolves. That's where his strength lies. So here he is, this shepherd, experienced in the use of a devastating weapon, up against this lumbering giant weighed down by 100 pounds of armor and these incredibly heavy weapons that are useful only in short-range combat. Goliath is a sitting duck. He doesn't have a chance, right? So why do we keep calling David an underdog, and why do we keep referring to his victory as improbable? The second piece of this that's important, it's not just that we misunderstand David and his choice of weaponry. It's also that we profoundly misunderstand Goliath. Goliath is not what he seems to be. There's all kinds of hints of this in the biblical text. Things that are, in retrospect, are quite puzzling and don't square with his image as this mighty warrior. So to begin with, the Bible says that Goliath is led onto the valley floor by an attendant. Now that is weird, right? Here is this mighty warrior going, challenging the Israelites to one-on-one combat. Why is he being led by the hand, by some, you know, young boy, presumably, to the point of combat? Secondly, the Bible story makes special note of how slowly Goliath moves. Another odd thing to say when you're describing the mightiest warrior known to man at that point, right? And then there's this whole weird thing about how long it takes Goliath to react to the sight of David. So David's coming down the mountain, and he's clearly not preparing for hand-to-hand combat, right? There is nothing about him that says, I'm about to fight you like this. He's not even carrying a sword. Why does Goliath not react to that? It's as if he's oblivious to what's going on that day. And then there's that strange comment he makes to David. Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? Right? Sticks? David only has one stick. Well, it turns out that there's been a great deal of speculation within the medical community over the years about whether there's something wrong with, fundamentally wrong with Goliath, an attempt to make sense of all of those apparent anomalies. There have been many articles written. The first one was in 1960 in the Indiana Medical Journal, and it started a chain of speculation that starts with an explanation for Goliath's height. So Goliath is head and shoulders above all of his peers in that era. And usually when someone is that far out of the norm, there's an explanation for it. So the most common form of giantism is a condition called acromegaly. And acromegaly is caused by a benign tumor on your pituitary gland that causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. And throughout history, many of the most famous giants have all had acromegaly. So the tallest person of all time was a guy named Robert Wadlow, who was still growing when he died at the age of 24, and he was 8'11". He had acromegaly. Do you remember the wrestler Andre the Giant, famous? He had acromegaly. There's even speculation that Abraham Lincoln had acromegaly. Right? Anyone who's unusually tall, that's the first explanation we come up with. And acromegaly has a very distinct set of side effects associated with it, principally having to do with vision. The pituitary tumor, as it grows, often starts to compress the visual nerves in your brain, with the result that people with acromegaly have either double vision or they are profoundly nearsighted. So when people have started to speculate about what might have been wrong with Goliath, they said, wait a minute, he looks and sounds an awful lot like someone who has acromegaly. And that would also explain so much of what was strange about his behavior that day, right? Why does he move so slowly and have to be escorted down into the valley floor by an attendant? Because he can't make his way on his own, right? Why is he so strangely oblivious to David that he doesn't understand that David's not going to fight him until the very last moment? Because he can't see him, right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the phrase come to me is a hint also of his vulnerability. Come to me because I can't see you, right? And then there's, am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? He sees two sticks when David has only one. So the Israelites up on the mountain ridge looking down on him thought he was this extraordinarily powerful foe. What they didn't understand was that the very thing that was the source of his apparent strength was also the source of his greatest weakness. And there is, I think, in that a very important lesson for all of us. Giants are not as strong and powerful as they seem. And sometimes the shepherd boy has a sling in his pocket. Thank you.
When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, and you want to smile but have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is queer with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns. And many a failure turns about when he might have won if he'd stuck it out. Don't give up, though the pace seems slow. You might succeed with another blow. Often the struggler has given up when he might have captured the victor's cup. And he learned too late when the night slipped down how close he was to the golden crown. Success is failure turned inside out, the silver tint of clouds of doubt. And you never can tell how close you are. You may be near when it seems afar. So stick to the fight when your heart is hit. It's when things seem worst that you mustn't quit.
No, we can't run it. That's our only option.
You gotta kick it, man. David.
I need a 51-yard field goal.
Coach, I can't kick that far.
David, they've been stopping the run and the pass all night. You're my best option.
Coach, the farthest I've ever kicked is a 39-yarder. There's no way I can kick a 51-yard field goal.
I believe you can. Your job is to do the best you can and leave the results up to God. I need you on that field.
Our field goal unit. Grant, we've got to throw it. He can't kick it from there. It's too far.
No, it's not.
What are you doing?
I'm preparing for rain.
I don't understand this, but with 2 seconds left on the clock, Coach Grant Taylor and the Shiloh Eagles are putting the game in the hands of a 145-pound backup kicker.
This is not a good move on Grant Taylor's part. He even has to kick into the wind.
David! David! He's not ready, Granny. Don't think he can do it.
I don't have any more timeouts. Call a timeout, Bobby Lee.
This kid can't kick that far.
Call that timeout.
Call a timeout anyway, and let's ice him.
Hey, come here.
David, you telling yourself you're going to miss this kick?
Coach, it's too far.
Listen to me. Do you think God could help you make this kick? Do you believe it, David?
Yeah, if he wants to.
So do I. But you have got to give me your best and leave the rest up to him. Will you do that for me? David, whether you make this field goal or not, we're going to praise him. But don't you walk off this field having done any less than your best.
Can I help you?
Don't touch me. I'm standing for my son.
God, help me make this kick. Kick it now! Kick it now!
Kick is up, it's on its way. It's long enough, it's high enough. Does it have the distance? It does! It's gone! I can't believe what I just seen. I cannot believe what I just seen. A miracle has occurred here tonight. The Shiloh Eagles have defeated the Richmond Giants 24-23 to take the state title for the first time in their history. It's incredible. It's absolutely unbelievable.
You are state champions. You are state champions.
Something to say. David Childers. Don't you ever let anyone tell you that you're under par, second rate, or inferior. I just watched God do a miracle through you. I saw a field of giants, 85 of them to be exact, fall in defeat. Now you tell me what's impossible with God.
Nothing, Coach.
Zach, I just watched you and the offense do what they said could not be done. Now you tell me what's impossible with God.
Nothing, Coach.
Brock, how about it? Built that stone wall, didn't you? And it stood. Now you tell me what's impossible with God.
Nothing, Coach.
How about it, Scott? What's impossible with God?
Nothing.
Are you sure? Because those giants are big. They outnumber 3-1. Are you sure there's nothing impossible with God?
I'm sure, Coach.
How about it, Nathan? What's impossible with God?
Nothing, Coach.
Jonathan?
Nothing.
Are you positive?
Positive, Coach.
So am I. So am I. God can do whatever he wants to do, however he wants to do it. And he chooses to work in our lives because he loves us. OK? because he's good. Hope today is a milestone for what he can do for the rest of your life if you trust him. And we spend some time thanking him.
Tell Jake to make sure the tarp's ready. We'll check with the weather service by 5, and we'll make a decision then. Hey. What you doing here? Don't you have practice?
Not anymore. I quit.
Oh. Well, since when are you the quitting kind?
I don't know. I just don't see the point anymore.
So you didn't make the dress list. There are greater tragedies in the world.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad. To prove to everyone
prove
that I worked...
what?
That I was somebody.
Oh, you are so full of crap. You're 5 feet nothing, 100 and nothing, and you got hardly a speck of athletic ability. And you hung in with the best college football team in the land for 2 years. And you're also going to walk out of here with a degree from the University of Notre Dame. In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself. And after what you've gone through, if you haven't done that by now, it ain't gonna never happen. Now go on back.
Sorry I never got you to see your first game in here.
Hell, I've seen too many games in this stadium.
I thought you said you never saw a game.
I've never seen a game from the stands.
You were a player?
I rode the bench for 2 years. Thought I wasn't being played because of my color. I got filled up with a lot of attitude. So I quit. Still not a week goes by, I don't regret it. And I guarantee a week won't go by in your life. You won't regret walking out, letting them get the best of you. You hear me clear enough?